This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Yeah, that is one of the drawbacks of the table setup.
I'm good.
All right, ready?
Just a few pieces of foam.
Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am your host, Chris Spangle. To my right, to my immediately right, that's English. It's Greg Lenz. Greg, how are you?
Doing well, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing well. I haven't gotten much sleep lately, and I am apparently not able to speak.
I thought you took a 6-hour nap yesterday.
I did. I have slept like crazy, but I'm also not sleeping at night. So I am like the perfect combination of tired and mentally rested.
Oh, man.
And so like I'm really pissy, but I'm also really sharp.
Mm. That won't end well for us, Harry.
No, that sounds like a collegiate high.
Yeah. That is Harry Price.
Hello, everybody.
How are you, Harry?
I'm going good. I finally got crossed 100,000 miles in my rotary. Yeah, one build on a rotary motor at 100,000 miles. Ha, take that, piston lovers.
Harry is our favorite in-resident techno-nerd.
Techno-nerd slash senior black correspondent.
Senior black correspondent, if you can't tell by his voice. Harry is an African-American.
No, I'm just an American.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. He's black.
Yes, black.
So he will be here to make all you white people uncomfortable because we know we have absolutely no diversity listening to this podcast, with the exception of Joe Ruiz and Aria Torres, our Puerto Rican contingent.
Is that what they are?
Yeah.
I always, we've talked about it a million times, and I just never can quite figure out what the... James Neese might have nailed it when he called them parallel Mexicans.
Yeah, we weren't here last week because we had an event... but if you didn't listen to the James Neese episode, you missed out. You have to go back and listen to, I think, 108. Was it 108?
Yeah, 108. 108. 109 was Joe's interview with Sheriff Rogers.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. James is nuts.
He's positively delightful.
Yes.
In every way. from his Saddam mobile that he, rolls the mean streets of Frankfort, Indiana, the hot dogs. All the way down to his internet trolling and thug life.
I'm not that well-versed in the James Neese. So I was like, oh, he ran for political office. This guy's got to be like a stand-up gentleman. I can play this episode at work. I'll just turn this up and walk across the room.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I had a sprint from the back of the warehouse.
He's a Spangle candidate. He's the kind... Chris looks for that something extra in a candidate, and James has it.
I don't know what he has extra of, but it's probably not good.
Charisma,
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, he's got street cred.
Mental instability, yes.
Yeah. But that's every libertarian.
Right.
Yeah, everyone needs that, just that touch, that sprinkling of Asperger's.
Oh, man.
I said a sprinkle.
A sprinkle?
Yeah, it's just a sprinkle.
Just a touch.
Sprinkle of, yeah, just a sprinkle of the spectrum.
A dash, if you will.
Yeah.
Like ISIS.
Harry, what the hell are you up to? Well, how have you been?
Let's see. I've been burying my head in disgusting different... it's called the NIST 8800 bill for data destruction, and I've been burying my head in that for the last few weeks.
Oh, so we're 3 minutes in, and we're going to get started with real topics. We have to fulfill our 20-minute BS requirement, don't we? Oh.
Well, that's what I've been doing for work. I've also been trying to get different stuff on like different servers. I won't bore anyone on the 8800 NIST for certification for data destruction. It's a great ripping talk document. I recommend picking it up if you want to know how to.
Is it federal legislation?
Yeah. It's how we destroy data in the.
Who administers it?
The National Institute for. What the heck did the ST stand for? I've been.
So it's not legislation, then it's
they recommend
regulatory guidelines.
They recommend it. that you follow these guidelines.
Yeah, like the EPA.
Yeah, strictly.
Then they take your cattle.
I have to get coasters. I'll be right back.
Why?
Because you people are putting water rings in my table. What are you doing? I'm not really mad. It's okay.
Okay, good.
If everyone wants to know, he's turning red, maple syrup red at us.
Shut up, you.
That's violence, sir.
It's not a hate crime yet.
And you thought it was bad when he asked you to get the door last time. Mm-hmm. Wait till you see what this turns into.
I know. I'm surprised he didn't tell me to go get the coasters.
Right? Didn't he ask you to bring fried chicken, too?
Yes, he did.
Actually,
yes,
I did. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, you did.
I was going to deny it, but I can't.
Yeah, you really did.
It might be on a messenger somewhere.
Mm-hmm. It is.
I will give him credit. He wasn't on time today. I was impressed.
Yeah. Took a lot of work out of me to come late.
I'll tell you, I did it. It's a personal attack if somebody shows up on time
or
early.
And you have a lot of friends that are like people that just drop in.
No, I Jeremiah Morrill's on my list.
I know. I would never be friends with that person. Like, that's an act against me.
Yeah.
You do not respect me as an individual. Mm-hmm. We are no longer friends.
He makes up for it, though, because he took me to Giacomo's Pizza, second or first in the great pizza wars of my belly. We had Brazzini's before this, and that's always a solid, solid choice.
Delicious.
It was great.
Stomach hurts.
Yeah, it's so good. And so he showed up to take me to Giacomo's. Now, I had $7 because it was the day before payday.
Yeah.
And I told him that, but he thought I was kidding. Mm-hmm. And then the bill came, and I pulled out my $7, and he said, "Where's the rest of it?" And I said, "I told you I had $7.
Yeah, you get four. I might need $3 for something else tonight."
And then he got mad at me, and I said, "Listen, bro, I warned you, and you did the pop-in.
That violates the NAP to me. You show
it really
up
does.
At my house. I don't even care if you give. If it's not a full day's warning, it is an aggression against me."
And I have a screenshot somewhere of you. I'm not happy with you and Joe. Because I have a screenshot on my phone somewhere of two voicemail messages, one from Greg Lins and the next from Joe Ruiz. Unlistened, did not listen to them.
When?
It was around the Liberty Street. It was around a week ago.
But oh, I was returning your call after you called me.
The very people who should know better than to leave a message.
Called me and left me a voicemail.
Did I?
That's why I responded. I retaliated.
Oh, see, okay.
I'm allowed to by the NAP. I can return fire. Once aggressed against, I'm good.
Okay, all right. All is forgiven then.
Not Joe.
No. Joe is dead to me.
He's a salesman. They're callers.
He can't. He's on the road. He's got his Bluetooth in. He's on the phone. He's doing the double finger guns.
He totally does. Sir, put your trust in me, and I'll never have to ask for it again.
I am not in sales. I'm in solutions.
Oh. Don't buy my product. Buy me.
Sent a photo out on the Instagram. And if you go to our Instagram, We Are Libertarians, or our Facebook page, you can see a photo of Harry and Greg as Greg walked in with the beer and the pizza, and Harry's hanging out in the We Are Libertarians green room, i.e. my couch.
Casting couch, really.
A friend of the show writes, "Does Greg act like a frat boy? Does he know this that his hat is backwards? Turn it around for him. It will work better that way."
Who is it?
None of your business. So it's not online. It was a private message. But this is spreading. James Neese has lit a fire.
You started it.
Did I?
You did.
I'll take credit.
Started it. And then James built it up more, and then Aaron Ewert. Yeah, Ewert. He continued. Then Harry called me a pledge in front of the chicks on the right. Oh, yeah, he did. Don't think that I was going to forget about that, Harry. You actually made pictures and memes of me saying, "Quit being such a fledge or pledge, bro." I want you to know you sided with the chicks on the right.
Well,
have they had you on their show?
No.
This is the guy that comes into my home on my podcast, excuse me, Greg, and says that he likes the chicks on the right.
Yes.
There isn't any excuse for it. They're the two dumbest people on the planet. Okay, maybe not on the planet, but at least on WIBC.
It's like I said, it's a nice, easy listen to on the ride home after waking up early in the morning, listening to all these other heavy hitting podcasts.
Listen to the smooth jazz station on Pandora or something if you need easy going.
No, I need something easier.
Well, there's nothing hard about the content that is being put out. Nothing intellectual
exactly.
Coming out of the mouth of those two. So
I'll tell you though, I judge without listening. which mm-hmm. I am want to do, and I do it quite often.
And but, it's your right as a man.
It is. It is. But so I actually listened, and like they've been absolutely atrocious, especially after the day they got all wrestled and quit Facebook because of us.
Yeah.
We have to tell that story.
Yeah, because of the fraternal order that showed up.
the massive blocking on their site,
I
too.
I like that somehow We Are Libertarians has started to summon the dregs of the brutalist groups to help us start trolling people.
I know, and I swear it's like the bat signal is up and tags everybody, and then it just descends down on everyone.
So but, you pulled your trap card?
I was triggered. They triggered me.
You triggered your trap card?
They triggered my trap card, but... yeah, so where were we going with? Where was I going with that? It was something along the lines.
So you
of,
listened hey. To?
Oh, I didn't. They were actually good today. I agreed with them and didn't want to didn't want to turn it off. They were mocking Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown, because the president's been trying to get them to help with the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement,
mm-hmm.
and he had called her Elizabeth and him Sherrod, but he did it talking to a reporter. And they said it was, disrespectful. And they were mocking.
Yeah, because that's all they do. They just do.
But they were mocking Elizabeth Warren. Like, oh, I have to be called senator. Like, and I was like, you guys, this is wonderful. Mm-hmm. You're trolling.
that's all they do. I mean, they are this. There's this crop of current Republican bloggers that do nothing but snark.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, I'm snark blogging the State of the Union address. I'm going to be so outrageous by making sarcastic comments. And sarcasm not done well is just, in the humor world, the bane of and it's just the lowest form of comedy, which is why I employ it almost every sentence of the day.
And I'm shocked. That voice you just did was incredibly like Dana Lash.
Was it?
Oh, my gosh. Like, you had Dana Lash nailed.
Oh, want to punch a speaker.
Yeah. I feel bad now that I sound like Dana Lash. Do I sound like a girl?
No, when you were doing the girl voice.
Oh, the girl voice, okay.
The girl voice, like the snarky girl voice.
Oh, yeah. So coming up next on the show, we're going to talk about President Obama. Can you believe this? This is my female talk radio impression.
That is Dana Lash. Yeah,
so, because they all talk like this. And, you know, the thing about it is, it's amazing that these people can get away with this. They're such racists themselves, but they love to call us racists. We'll be
and
right
they hate
back.
America.
We'll be right back. You know, it's that, like, I'm making a point. I don't know. Yeah.
No, I know. It's just that the like tone they have and the pitch of their voice. You could literally be giving away free afterlives of like parties like with Charlie Sheen for eternity, and no one would want to buy it if they heard it pitched in that voice.
Yeah, the thing about talk radio is that it's very difficult. There's a reason that when I wanted to do a podcast and I bought this equipment that I enlisted Galt and Creighton. Because for me to sit here and talk by myself in a room, not only does it sound like forced and you have to be really talented at it for it to be even remotely interesting, which is why people like, I mean, even Glenn Beck has an entourage now. But he's great on a monologue, but the best parts of his show are when he's talking to Pat and Stu.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Limbaugh is very talented, and it probably would be better if he had like an on-air co-host. You know, all the talk radio guys have that sort of sidekick character.
And he does use Snerdly from time to time, but never lets him talk.
Yeah,
right.
On air.
And I've heard Snerdly talk. He has a beautiful Harry-like voice.
Yeah.
Very deep. A nice lilt, as we say in the business. He has a nice lilt.
Lilt.
But yeah, I mean, that's part of the reason we have like an ensemble cast and rotating people. You know, Greg's here every week.
Just because I won't not come.
Because I know he's dependable. and then, you know, we rotate in a cast of thousands.
Yes.
Of about 13 other people, so it doesn't get stale and boring.
It's a long bench. It's kind of like a baseball team. You got to keep switching out your pitchers once in a while.
Exactly right. Because I hear from people, they're like, you know, if you had my on every time, it'd be too much. If you had, you know, people seem to like Harry.
Yay. Thank you.
Well, that's the thing is now libertarians can be like, yeah, I listen to this podcast. They have a black guy.
Oh.
I only kid, my brother.
It's okay.
Only kid.
Sometimes I get that from new libertarians, especially when I go to like an event. They're like, oh my God, there's a black guy. And they want to talk with me. It's the weirdest thing in the
Can
world.
Can I get a picture?
Well, sometimes I go to events and like I will be in like, oh, sometimes like if I'm in the room, I'm in the photo. They've made sure they've, okay, I got to make sure he's in the square. Okay, take the photo.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Chris did it when I went to the YAL State Conference. There's so many different photos from the YAL Conference. Like, I got to make sure I got Harry there in the room. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I totally did that. I'm not lying. He's not lying either.
There's only black guy in the room.
Oh, man. I thought we were all about principles. We don't worry about such things and appearances. We're all about substance.
No.
Not at all.
No.
No. We want to be just like them.
Aw.
Well, not the Republicans.
Well, we should maybe talk about the stuff going on in the world. There's so much going on. Privacy has kind of cropped its way back up in a big way. So why don't you kind of, Greg, do a flyover of the brief topics that we're going to talk about?
Sure, yeah. So we'll touch briefly on, privacy for sure, since we had a federal appeals court rule that the data collection practices of the United States government authorized by the Patriot Act were unconstitutional. And then the Patriot Act was scheduled to sunset at the end of June, I believe. Mm-hmm. And the bill had been stalled in the Senate for reauthorization. And it looks like now the House passed that about earlier today.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yep. Yes.
Oh, unanimously passed it 313-88
mm-hmm.
or something along those lines. And then I'd say with one big story today I thought was really interesting, and not many people picked it up, especially in the major media, but Kim.com, the guy with the upload service out of New Zealand that's in jail, he did an interview.
It's a mega upload?
Mega upload. He did an interview, and he said Julian Assange has date or information he's going to leak on Hillary Clinton.
Ooh.
Yes.
And none of the major sources, of course, like picked it up because, you know, I don't really know why, but I feel like that's the kind of thing that get headlines, because if you put Clinton's in scandal, like it's all the clicks you need for the month.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but Dredge might have linked it, but no one else I saw really commented on it. And then we're going to talk about the secrecy by the most transparent administration in history around the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade treaty that's...
Does this involve Maya?
What? Oh, you're gonna pay for that because you're podcasting with her next week.
Are you not coming? You're gonna be here. We are going to talk about. Maya does things that we don't understand. Mm-hmm. Maya got herself into a bit of a situation.
A tizzy.
So we're going to talk about the situation that she might be in.
A kerfuffle.
This is a little more than a kerfuffle.
Yeah,
close to a fruckus.
She's not been shot and murdered yet.
Yeah. Threatened.
Threatened.
By
hardcore.
Sock accounts on Facebook, which is the most scary thing to be probably threatened by.
So we're going
to
talk about that next week.
Yeah. Okay. Well, no, the treaty that President Obama is negotiating in secret with 9 other countries.
Say it. What is it?
The Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Hilarious.
He loves that word, trans.
Mm.
He really does.
I know. It's hilarious to me.
Trans?
It's one of my best friends is trans. I can make those jokes.
Oh,
just like why I can make
go.
Black jokes with Harry here.
That's good.
And Native American jokes with you here.
Well, you're Native American, too.
Well, I'm like 1/16 Cherokee and Choctaw.
Oh, you have double? You're a hybrid?
I'm double. I'm not. So that makes me like 1/32nd.
Oh, my gosh. No, that makes you 2/16.
That's racist, okay? Let's not go back to the original Constitution with Harry here, all right?
Oh, you know what I think is the most impressive part of this intro is how you've been able to have a full conversation on Facebook right now while paying attention. Has it not been impressive, Harry?
Very impressive.
I'm a multi-talented
You are totally...
individual.
What's going on over there?
Nothing's going on over here.
Uh-huh.
Mm. So,
something is afoot.
Yes.
There's nothing ever afoot. Nobody needs to get involved in my business.
He's dual screening.
Hey, what is wrong with your mouse? Your mouse looks broken, Harry.
My mouse isn't broken. It's a Matcat Rat 7 mouse. It has a you can basically change different things on it. It's
all right, I don't care. I was just changing the subject, Harry.
And then I've got
you can stop now.
In it. So I've got like
so
the max
back to
in it.
The reauthorization of the Patriot Act. See, I just figured I'd get Greg onto something shiny and away from me. That's how that works.
Oh no,
see?
I haven't forgot.
Broadcast. Now you. So basically, they came out with something called the USA Freedom Act today.
Yes,
let's kind of go back a week to the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Second Circuit, and they ruled that the bulk telephone metadata program run by the National Security Agency is not authorized by Section 215 of the Patriot Act and is thus unlawful. This is Justin Amash writing this. The ruling is a big win for privacy and civil liberties advocates who have long argued that Section 215 clearly does not contemplate the type of mass collection we now know is occurring. But the win will be short-lived if H.R. 2048, the latest version of the USA Freedom Act, that's scheduled to be considered by the House this afternoon, becomes the law. We'll get into 2048 here in a minute, but let's kind of go back and revisit what it means that the U.S. Supreme Court of Appeals has ruled that the bulk telephone metadata program run by the NSA, I mean, that validates. We should bring Snowden back and give him a parade, not a trial.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
He exposed it, he and he alone, and he tried the traditional back channels. He followed protocol. That got shut down, as it does under this administration, since they've prosecuted more whistleblowers than any of the rest of the presidents in history.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so Edward Snowden now, he probably should be fired by his employer.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
As far as being a traitor or something treasonous, he is a patriot, if you are into such type of things.
Right.
Yeah.
Such notions of nationalism.
Mm-hmm. Which was refreshing because
what we'll talk about next week in burning the flag. Yeah,
yeah. Cool, because like most people in the tech industry suspect a lot of this stuff is happening and was trying to convince people to, you know, you should encrypt your phones, you should do stuff like this, and no one was doing that. Thankfully, when Snowden did come out and say all this, you've got a lot of people using encryption now, a lot more people actually, you know, going out and wanting to know how to encrypt their phones, how to give privacy back in their life. You know, we fought very hard to get to keep encryption in the public space in the 90s. A lot of people did, not myself, but a lot of people earlier on in the tech industry did fight to keep encryption. So we have it. Use it. That is one good thing I do give Apple for. They built in encryption into their operating system. They make it default on to all their users. There is no NSA backdoor to the Apple encryption. They cannot unencrypt their software. At least that's what they say, if you trust Apple.
That's the question I had, though, is if it's subpoenaed by the court of law, they turn the data over still, and then how, if it is encrypted, can they be forced to provide any type of password, or would that violate the Fifth Amendment?
They cannot force you as a person to unencrypt your phone with a passcode, to remember your passcode. But let's say you use a biometric lock, like it's your face or your thumb.
Yeah.
They can put your hand in your face in front
of
the camera. Yes, they can.
That's been that was an established ruling about a year ago, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, I remember that. Now, granted, the biometric stuff hasn't taken off completely yet, thank God.
Yeah. And, well, that's also, took a lot of the wind out of it, because it was a lot of people still use it, though, in their phones. They like the selfie lock. Well, my phone's encrypted. Well, what's the key lock on it? Oh, I take this massive selfie. I was like, so what? I hold your head straight and I take the photo.
Well, that was awfully violent of you.
Yeah.
That's intense. How you get in. You
so
know,
Harry's an ISIS.
Yeah, no kidding. That's exactly what I was about to say. I was like, Harry, Allahu Akbar, does that mean anything to you? Answer me!
And then, that's why people look at me funny. It's like, what's up with your, I'm not going to say how many characters are in my passcode, but I do have a very long passcode.
That's what we heard.
And the reason why, because it's really hard to break my lock code.
Yeah.
I want it to be that way.
Mine is four characters. I have one capital letter.
Four characters?
Four characters.
And one capital
and
letter?
And two of them are numbers. You'll never figure it out.
Wow.
It's probably admin.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Or disco.
1, 2, capital A, lowercase b.
Damn it.
Disco spelled with a zero.
You're all stupid because it's password one. Okay? Capital P, password one.
A, dollar sign for the S's. Yeah.
There's an underscore in there somewhere.
People don't use the dollar signs in their password thing. Yeah. I'll tell you, people, do better with your passwords. You're putting us all at risk.
Change your passcodes like you change your underwear once a month.
Really? You'd recommend that much?
I honestly change your password actually every week. You should probably change it all the time.
I change because
you should rotate.
Because
depending on what you're securing.
Greg, as you know, I have a significant amount of friends on Facebook. so I'm almost at the limit. I'm nearly to 5,000 friends on Facebook.
Who did you trim? Because you were there.
A lot of dead accounts, a lot of Democrats, a lot of Puerto Ricans. sorry, Joe, you didn't make the cut. I left most of the college girls. if you're a y'all member, you're still in. No, that's not. No, just like you get rid of the deactivated accounts.
Yeah.
But I change my password every month. At least, with your Facebook and your Gmail, especially, and your Twitter to a lesser extent, but with Facebook, because you're connected to so many other people, and especially if my account gets hacked, then that puts a lot of people at risk.
Yeah,
you know, mm-hmm. if you have 1,000 friends on Facebook and you get hacked, you're putting 1,000 people at risk. Mm-hmm. And so you also have all these other accounts that are connected to your Facebook.
Yes.
And so I go in, and I clear out on Google and Twitter and Facebook. I revoke access for all the apps that I don't use, sign out of all the sessions, change my password. Use something like LastPass, which has a Facebook pass generator.
Yes.
And that creates a super secure password.
I was going to recommend the password, like a password manager. It's the easiest way.
What if they get hacked and then they got all your passwords? No, they're not hacked. They're just created by the government, like Oracle.
Right. LastPass has been hacked before. Nothing came out of it for anybody. They're very,
why would you tell anybody?
Right. So, trust me, I die, you all can get on anything I ever did.
Sweet.
Well, you've already told me that I get your account over Maya.
Yeah.
If you were to pass away.
You won out over Maya because of one particular meme. Not one that you created of me, but because you were more brutal than she was. And I need a master troll. If I'm going to live on in death, mm-hmm. I will live on as I did in life, trolling the shit out of you people on Facebook.
Hell, come with me.
Oh. You don't have that life insurance policy where they freeze your head?
Yes.
The Ted Williams?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not. Never mind.
No, that is a legit company that they will pay money into. They get your head, they freeze it so you can be that head in a jar. Or you get your robot body when they finally get the robot bodies built.
Yeah.
And you have the strength of 10 gorillas.
A what?
10 gorillas. No C-Lab 2120.
All right, so moving on. Let's go back to the NSA.
You could cut the white guilt with a knife in here.
Oh, Harry. Man. Greg, can you get the door? Can I get you anything, Harry? A drink of water, a check.
It's okay. I got my scotch. I'm fine. Oh,
man. He didn't bring you pizza because he's nice. Those are reparations.
36 more to go.
36 more pizzas and his slate is clean. So if you're black, contact Greg at Lens at Weird Liberty.
Oh, no. I do a buddy system. I pick one and I'm good. I just don't,
Oh, I feel like we're in dangerous territory. Are you okay with everything that's happening here? Please be our racism.
Are you triggered?
You aren't triggered, are you?
No, it's cool. You guys are fine.
All right. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. We're good. Everything's good.
All right. That sounded convincing.
Yeah. Okay.
One more joke.
but back to the NSA spy thing. When they did, like, I enjoy people like talking about encryption, wanting to encrypt things because Windows has a terrible encryption. And, I have my Windows Lenovo machine here, but this is my traveling laptop. This is the one that I don't really care about. There's not much on this thing. This one's not encrypted whatsoever. If you want it, you can own it and pwn this thing all you want. There's nothing really on it.
Well, that's the other thing, though, is how much do you really keep on your hard drive anymore? How much does anybody?
A lot of things if you don't erase it correctly.
But external hard drives is what I would use, or I use the cloud services.
I use mine mostly for Playboy spreads. Isn't that what you use yours for?
I have the magazines. I'm old school.
Oh, okay.
People leave data everywhere, though. Especially with hard drive size getting so large.
Here's the expert. You work at a data reclamation center or something, right?
We destroy people's data.
Yes, you bring. You've got your old e-junk,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Harry over here. What's the name of your company? Plug them if you're an indie. Do you want to?
Probably not.
No, all right.
No,
okay.
I'm good.
It is.
It's a local tech recycler of electronic stuff here in town, inside Indianapolis. Whatever. Anyways, we destroy your data when it comes into our building. The whole building is designed to be destroy data. We get audits all the time from different companies to make sure we are destroying data effectively.
Not a government agency? There's no data. There's no government regulation.
There is an organization that is a voluntary organization that we belong to, that people trust that organization.
Oh, this
to
make is sure not things, good.
But they follow the government's guidelines for data destruction.
I'm just saying, I think we need the government to regulate this. I don't know that we can trust private corporations to police themselves.
The Data Reclamation Administration?
Right.
DRA? I preferably want Anthony Weiner to be the one that's in charge of it. If we could appoint him secretary, that'd be fantastic.
Just Sydney Leathers. Yeah. Put her in charge. She can find every scummy piece.
You guys put me in a weird position because like my company's large enough that we could probably live through all these regulations. The other businesses that probably will not.
No.
We are, of course, being facetious. I'm pointing out that you don't need the government to do something that private organizations are already doing.
But I can stop all the upstart companies. This way that it's just us. We'd be... You know, make sure we're the most responsible data recyclers in the state, and then we'll just make sure we have no competition.
Then one of their managers shows up on a libertarian podcast, and they go right out of business.
Oh, great, yeah.
No, but
people leave small data behind, we make sure that gets destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Like the older Android phones and the older Apple phones, they have terrible data destruction properties inside of them. A lot of the older Android phones, there's no good way of taking the data off them. If your Android phone cannot encrypt itself, it cannot be deleted ever, ever.
Now with iPhones, I think you just turn on your passcode and automatically encrypts it. But with Android, you got to take an extra step, right?
Correct. You have to take an extra step. That's also the beauty with the one thing I will give with Apple, that it will connecting an Apple. You can hit it with either a rec boot or something like that, or if giving someone an iPhone to update and restore, it will connect to their server. Erase everything on that app on the iOS device and reinstall the iOS image on it, ensuring that the data has been destroyed on your Apple device,
right?
Not so much on Android. You know, just hitting I've just hit the factory restore, da-da, it's done. No, there's so much data left on there.
So can they be wiped clean, though?
What, an Android phone?
Yeah, if you've never encrypted it?
No, yes and no. Basically, you have to make the data unrecoverable. So the best way to do that is to encrypt it and get rid of the key. Get a random key.
So it's still on there. It's just completely encrypted.
Yeah, you can't do anything with it.
Gotcha.
The data's there, but
so really, it's never.
Yeah, but you can corrupt it to a point that it's unrecoverable.
Yeah,
or if you do recover it, it would take you so long. Yeah, it's unusable. Or that by the time you do uncover it, it's 10 years later.
That's interesting. I just assumed that you could always, no matter what, wipe a hard drive clean.
You can wipe a hard drive to a point. That's why I like SSDs a little bit better. They're easier to wipe because it's just flash media versus the magnetic disk inside of a mechanical hard drive.
Yeah.
The easiest way to erase in a mechanical hard drive is to keep writing data to it, random ones and zeros basically to the drive. The problem with that is if the drive is older, it probably won't live through that. But you did erase hopefully you erased enough in it, and then you simply just can crush it after that.
Okay.
Because also certain crushing a drive, also in the NIST 888, they actually tell you shooting a hard drive is not properly erasing. Actually, some students at Purdue actually have done that, has shot a hard drive with a shotgun and actually pulled the data off it.
They still could.
Yes.
That's incredible. So you could, the whole office space where they're destroying the fax machine and the printer and all that stuff.
Yes.
That really is not effective whatsoever. Well, I guess
for
faxing and printing services, probably.
That's the other thing. When people get rid of printers and fax machines and like that, they don't understand that those machines also have memory in it and hard drives in it.
Yeah?
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They do.
Yep. I had to show that to a lot of different people who was like, oh, this printer's fine. So I was like, no, there's a hard drive in it. And you can go into the memory inside the hard drive in a lot of the printers, and you'll print out last 100 documents. They'll just start printing.
Wow.
Has them stored.
Now, there are certain printer companies out there that have started encrypting that data, making that data on that printer hard to remove and hard to get off.
Yeah.
I applaud those companies that do that.
Hmm.
Wow, that's really interesting. I had no idea. I didn't know it was that minute. That I thought it probably could remember, its last function. You know what I mean?
But the thing is, especially the bigger enterprise ones, they're set up for this is the printer for the floor.
Yeah.
So 100 people could print to this thing at one time, 10 pages documents, so it's got to save and hold.
Yep, that's no, that makes sense actually. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yep. We don't, you know, centralization kills yes. everything. It's the bane of existence.
Well, because it's easier to network one printer than put a printer at each person's desk and let them print out individually.
Yeah, but it creates more jobs if you have individual printers.
Well, yeah, because someone's got to go and clean their printer once in a while, make sure they have paper, make sure they have toner, and maintain them.
He doesn't like creating jobs. He likes destroying them with computers.
Clearly, listen to that episode with Gina.
Uh-huh.
They about came to fisticuffs.
I'll tell you what, nobody loves to... like, if we joke about the fight between Creighton and Galt, mm-hmm. Gina has caused more almost physical fights.
I thought Gina, she and Peffers could not, like, no one could ever match that animosity.
No. Gina and Peffers, Dan Peffers, hate each other, and therefore she does not like Chris Peffers. She called me a racist once, and I threw my phone. I got so pissed at her.
I remember this Sunday.
That I threw my phone across the room and cracked my iPhone.
Yeah.
She got into it with Harry. She's out of control.
That was getting into it?
For us, it was.
You should listen to...
Did you listen to that episode?
No, Gina was ready to attack you.
Yeah.
She was ready to beat your ass.
Oh, absolutely. If you had said that you had like a word processor that made, you know, grammar useless, she'd have come at you, bro. Oh, man. Well, so we probably ought to talk then, get into the part about the actual federal ruling. So it's basically, it outlaws the metadata, you know, mm-hmm. which, Harry, I know you know this better probably than I do, but to the extent I know it, it's basically the equivalent of, we can collect every piece of information around you, except we can't be inside your system monitoring what you do, or we can't like get the actual content of the call or something along those lines. We can get location, we can get probably websites accessed if it's a smartphone.
Why don't you explain what metadata is?
The metadata is basically like, it's almost like, what's the correct term for it? Because I want to say like a packet header. Basically, it's everywhere that data is going or have been. That's what they want. That's what they're pulling from it. It's basically like almost just like the log files.
Yep.
But even from like those log files, I can tell who did it, where did they went. Well, kind of where they went. But
Which towers were used to, mm-hmm. yeah.
What did they search? And then I almost create like a pattern and start like... Because you can enter all that stuff into a database, make it searchable, and just start looking for patterns.
Yeah.
Granted, you know, you can collect too much data to make the database perfectly much useless, which is kind of like what their database is now. They have so much data, it's useless.
Yeah.
Except for that if they wanted to target one person. That's the only thing it's useful for, is finding that one, like, upstart and going after that one person.
Yeah.
Finding out, like, the random outlier having that much data, it's virtually impossible.
Oh, you mean using it to have like predictive intelligence?
Yes, the predictive you can't.
Oh, yeah, 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 they, yeah, absolutely. But because as far as if they wanted to use it to put together a best guess of, you know, where you were, what mm-hmm. your patterns are, where you like, you know, what your daily life looks like, they can essentially put together all the circumstantial evidence necessary in like the court of law without actually having you confess.
Correct. Because let's say. I've got the metadata on my phone and my credit card. And let's see, every Saturday night I drive up to Detroit. And it just so happens every Saturday night I drive up to Detroit, someone gets murdered and I drive back to Indy. You know, technically there's metadata of me going all the way up I-69, getting stopped, getting gas, getting food, and coming back.
Making a call to somebody all the way here, uh-huh. all the way back.
Talking about making a call to one person, hanging up, then coming right back. And I just happened to be close to the tower where this person died.
Yeah. And then you used your phone to log into your bank account to make sure that there was a huge mm-hmm. deposit that exact
just
same time.
Just happened to get paid that day.
Yeah. No. So metadata is, you know, it basically just fills in the gaps without you ever getting a confession.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Right.
Yeah. And now, for the longest time, it was they could actually house and store the metadata. Then there was a reform where the companies had to – they actually held on to it, but they could request it anytime they wanted.
Correct, because storing that much data, backing it up, that gets expensive very quickly. Mm-hmm. I don't care what your budget is.
Yeah.
Which is probably why the NSA built this facility in Salt Lake City mm-hmm. that is a massive data center that is collecting, like, what is it, like – the Library of Congress every
week or day.
I have to look it. I'll have to look it up.
Yeah,
I mean those can only continue so long. Because they do require a lot of resources. It requires a crap load of power. Requires, like, the way people are fighting is with the water, being able to cool the servers, and so they're not allowing water access, like in Tennessee, in North Carolina, to the actual data farm, and so they're not able to. They may own the land. They may have already begun construction, and they get a thing from Indianapolis Public Water, saying, "Nope, sorry,
nope, we're not going to let you hook that up.
We don't want your kind here, NSA boy."
I don't know why Greg Lenz and Chris Mangel hates the NSA. I think they're awesome and have nice shoes.
The 1.7 billion facility, 2 years in the making, hosts supercomputers. Let's see. I just saw it right here. 10,000 laborers have built this facility. It's
So it is creating jobs, at least.
Yeah, lots of jobs. Paid for with money that does not exist.
Hasn't been earned yet.
Right. If one had the opportunity to collect all the voice traffic in the U.S., it would cost less than the Pentagon spends on paperclips. Storage these days is trivial. It's not a problem. This is Brewster Kahle, co-founder of the Internet Archive, founder of my favorite website, the Wayback Machine. I wish I could find this quickly and fastly, but I'm not. So I'll let you guys talk while I do a search.
Storage is cheap or trivial. Well, okay, to store stuff wouldn't be that bad, but to make sure it's backed up and backed up properly, you know, so you have to have like three different copies of it, have what, two on site and one off site? That gets expensive quickly.
Yeah, so it's storing data at, when it launched. 20 terabytes. So think of your 1 terabyte drive, 20 terabytes per minute.
Think about that, 6 terabyte SSD. Wow.
The equivalent of the Library of Congress per minute.
Wow.
And this article is from June 2013, and think of how many things have changed since June of 2013.
But we can't get Lois Lerner's emails.
Right.
And we're storing that amount of data every minute.
It is amazing the disconnect in government technology, where you have, you know, the VA can't computerize all these documents and can't get people help, and their computer system is from like 1996. And then you have the NSA and the technologies that they have, and how none of it just is so disjointed and disconnected.
Yes.
Well, yeah,
which is ridiculous because, like, the federal government requires businesses to keep email records for, what is it, 10 years?
Yeah.
The simple fact that they've stored all this data and each backup is apparently destroyed.
Well, they changed providers conveniently. The contract expired right before it would have been eligible for subpoena.
That's bull.
Unbelievable. Right? And shockingly, the provider was like, well, we decided not to keep it.
Oh, yeah, they were told not to keep it.
Yeah, exactly. And I know. It is, though. I mean,
because they would have to be required, even though, because if they were working for a government contract, they would be required to keep it for archiving purposes, no matter what was on it. It's like, okay, you know.
But Harry, they crashed.
So it's not a raid, or did someone watch this raid go down?
One of their tech repairmen just got white girl wasted and ran into one while listening to the new Taylor Swift song, and it crashed.
You can't say white girl wasted when I'm taking a drink.
Oh, I'm sorry. But I mean, you know, it's the hypocrisy that they're storing all this data on us, and they can't even. I mean, Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
I mean,
her private email server.
I mean,
that's amazing.
Private.
Yeah. It's so hard work to hold an email server. How much work that is. That's because.
But we'll print them out after my crack staff of lawyers have poured through, and you don't need to see the other 30,000. There's nothing in there but yoga appointments and correspondence for personal emails.
Yeah, that's the fact that they couldn't subpoena, not kick this person's door down to take that server is ridiculous. Considering they do that over a plant, they won't do this for like these hardware of what we need to know to find out what the heck happened.
Oh, it's
ludicrous.
It's the height of hypocrisy, but that is government the majority of the time, especially when they're threatened. They cannot be threatened. Yeah. Not now, not ever. And that's why they were all freaking out about the surveillance bill and then the court ruling, because, you know, now that the House has overwhelmingly passed it, overwhelmingly, we've got Ted Cruz, or
it's 338-88.
Yeah, but then you've got Rand Paul and Wyden have both agreed they will filibuster it if it's as the bill that was just passed by the House. So they are not going to let it get through the Senate.
Let's go through the bill, 248. I'm going to actually, this is a little long, but I think it's a good explanation from Justin Amash. Amash, Massey, Raul Labrador, Mark Sanford, some of the people who are kind of known as the libertarian wing, the libertarian-ish wing, you know. Yeah. Amash and Massey, I don't have qualms with them, but the, you know, you get into Mark Sanford and some of these other guys that are listed here, and
they're the economic liberty wing,
right? They all voted for it, so it was kind of like it's a little weird that they would vote for it. So I wanted to read Justin Amash's explanation. So here we go, putting on my Justin Amash character. 47 years ago, acting. All right, here we go. You will read all sorts of stories and headlines about how the latest USA Freedom Act ends bulk collection. It doesn't. In fact, the bill expressly authorizes, for the first time, the NSA, FBI, and other government agencies to unconstitutionally collect data in bulk on potentially millions of law-abiding Americans. Here's my full statement from Wednesday, which was yesterday, May 13th. On why I voted no on the USA Freedom Act. It's just, it kills me, man. Oh, the USA Freedom Act.
It would make Goebbels blush the way we name our bills.
Goebbels isn't even that. I mean,
like, you've gone too far.
So ham-handed. The Patriot Act, the Freedom Act. Last week, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit ruled the bulk telephone metadata program run by the NSA is not authorized by Section 215 of the Patriot Act and is thus unlawful. The ruling is a big win for privacy and civil liberty advocates who have long argued that Section 215 clearly does not contemplate the type of mass collection we now know is occurring. But the win will be short-lived if H.R. 2048, the latest version of the USA Freedom Act that's scheduled to be considered by the House this afternoon, becomes law. It went on to get passed 33-31 to 88, with an equal number of Republicans and Democrats voting against it. Section 215 authorizes the government to collect records and other tangible things that are relevant to terrorism or foreign intelligence investigations. To support the bulk collection of data pertaining to millions of law-abiding Americans, the government has effectively claimed that all records everywhere are potentially relevant to a current or future investigation, and thus all records are fair game for collection. In its ruling, the Second Circuit had little choice but to reject the government's broad interpretation of relevant. Given that the rest of the statute gives no indication Congress ever contemplated collection on such a mass scale. So far, so good. But H.R. 2048 threatens to undo much of the progress resulting from the Second Circuit's opinion. The bill's sponsors, and unfortunately some outside advocacy groups, wrongly claim that H.R. 2048 ends bulk collection. It's true that the bill ends the phone dragnet, as we currently know it, by having the phone companies themselves hold, search, and analyze certain data at the request of the government, which is worse in many ways given the broader set of data that the companies hold, but H.R. 2048 actually expands the statutory basis for the large-scale collection of most data. H.R. 2048 does this by authorizing the government to order the production of records based upon a specific selection term, i.e. like a search term used in the search engine. The records sought still must be relevant to an investigation, so it is possible that the court's rulings will continue to restrain the government in some fashion. But it's more likely a court looking at H.R. 2048 language will see specific selection term as defining the outer limits of what Congress considers acceptably relevant under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. Indeed, the Second Circuit encouraged Congress in reforming Section 215 to make a congressional judgment as to what is reasonable under the current circumstances. Unfortunately, the specific selection term is defined so broadly under the bill as to have little effect on narrowing the scope of items the government may obtain through a 215 order. A specific selection term may be a specific person, including a corporation such as Western Union, a specific account, address, a personal device. It also may be any other specific identifier, and the bill expressly contemplates using geographic regions or communication service providers, such as Verizon, to define the record sought, so long as it's not only the identifier used as part of the specific selection term. In other words, The bill doesn't let the government require Verizon to turn over all its records without limitation. But nothing appears to prevent the government from requiring Verizon to turn over all its records for all its customers in the state of New York. Only a politician or bureaucrat wouldn't call that bulk. H.R. 2048 gives our intelligence agencies, for the first time, statutory authority to collect Americans' data in bulk. In light of the Second Circuit's opinion that the NSA has been collecting our information in bulk without statutory authority for all this time, it would be a devastating misstep for Congress to pass a bill that codifies that bulk collection and likely ensures no future court will ever again be positioned to rule against government for over-collecting on statutory grounds. H.R. 2048 falls woefully short of reining in the mass collection of Americans' data, and it takes a step in the wrong direction by specifically authorizing such collection in violation of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. Americans, members of Congress, and members of Congress should demand that Congress instead pass the original bipartisan version of the U.S. Freedom Act from 2013, which strengthened, not weakened, Section 215's relevance standard to end bulk collection, while still allowing the government the flexibility it needs to pursue genuine threats against the United States. Now, I thought he voted for it, but that sounds awfully like he voted against it, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. So I'll have to check that source that said he voted for it. So we'll see. Okay. But a lot of good points in there.
Ultimately, I have a really... this is one of those issues where a lot of it's very nuanced. You know, there's, well, they can do this, but they can't, you know, they can't retain X for so long, or they have to house it here, and there's a... You know, there's a clearinghouse for the access of the data or whatever. But what they really, the real question is, should they be allowed to have any contractor, or should we switch to a provider that doesn't retain the data? Where is that in the market? Where is the person that says, you know what, we're just, since you don't want protection, let's start a telecom company that doesn't retain the data?
They force you to inside the United States border. That's why there's so many different VPN companies that started making so much money that are outside the United States.
Yeah, but who would be? Can any of them offer that here in the United States? I know they're all outside, but can they offer their services here? Well, or is there a way to access them?
You just access them. They're on the net. They're just servers.
Yeah, he voted against it. I'm sorry.
He voted against the bill.
He voted against the bill. Yeah. Okay. So sorry for. Misinforming you, dear leader listeners.
So who, what companies would those be?
Well, like different VPN companies?
Yeah. Just to give listeners, an example.
Well, there's, let's see, the most popular one I've heard is there's ProXPN. That one's a really good one. People like using that one. I use that one on occasion. Let's see. I like to use some of the once Avast finally used some of their VPN services outside of the United States, those servers, I like to use those because I like to mostly use like any type of VPN service outside of basically in New Zealand or other countries. I just kind of like just roam around.
Is there any way to ever recover that data, or we know they are not storing that?
A lot of them, they just give you. That's where it's also built on trust. You have to trust certain companies to do things.
Gotcha.
So it's a lot of people. That's why I like to. To be truly anonymous, like you have to go through different channels to be up there anonymously. Since they're collecting so much data, that's the only thing that it's really stopping is people going online anonymously. That's the only thing it stops.
Yeah,
because they collect everything. But like it's getting into particulars because getting online with the same serial number in the same location all the time, that's how they start tracing people down to who they are.
Yeah, a pattern of behavior.
But the other thing that you could do is like they got you. They're going to trace you. The best thing to do is to encrypt things. Encrypt all the things. Encrypt everything you can get your hands on. Do PGP encryption when you email your friends. And fully encrypt your hard drive.
The guy we talked to, Ladar Levinson.
Yeah.
Now his provider was shut down, correct? Email provider.
Lavabit's shut down.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because he was they wanted to force him to turn it over, and he just said no and destroyed it.
Yeah. Yes.
And then he went to work on was the Fire Phone after that.
The Amazon Fire Phone?
Yeah, not the Fire... Oh, it's the Fire Phone. What is it? The Black Phone. Sorry, Black Phone.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, he's doing... Because I actually just looked him up recently. He's doing more encryption stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it had something to do with a phone, and mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, he's kind of made his mission to go through and encrypt as much things as possible. Mm-hmm.
And educate people. He goes to different... he goes to DEF CON, he went to Black Hat, I think he went to SHMU, and was just talking to people about what happened to him on how LavaBit went down.
Yeah. And so...
And you can go and listen to that interview with him in our feed.
Now, I find it interesting, though, that the government won't prevent certain advancements in encryption as...
Really?
Well, no, but honestly, like, it'd be corruption... or obstruction of justice, would it not? If that data were ever needed?
They tried to do that in the 90s.
Yeah.
It's not really like they're stopping it. It's just the encryption we have is really, it's really strong, and they're trying to make it, and they're making the encryption better each day. There's so many different open source encryption protocols. The biggest problem is that most people are building these encryption, you know, it's either the algorithm. It's either a hobby for them. This is what they like doing. But the best people are at are getting paid by the government to create encryption or crack encryptions.
Gotcha. The cryptographers and mm-hmm. that the like. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Because it just seems to me that I would think, let's say you create like it's all an algorithm, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now I've seen, and this is movies, and this is the extent of my knowledge, but like the mutating algorithm where it's a different key code, or
it's
essentially
like, it changes itself while it's.
Well, it could be whatever, there's always a code, but it depends on the point in time that it's, you're in for mm-hmm. that to be the right access key.
The key pair changes.
Yeah.
And that changes so fast. There's people that do that. Like, there's some people that change their PGP encryption, like, every day, their encryption key. The problem with that, it's kind of hard to actually message people in between that.
Oh, yeah, because you don't have enough time for it to... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The best encryption for that is the old OnePad key. Ones, it's if both people have like the key codes basically on a pad together, and you just kind of like each time you use it, you pull off a number pad and you just keep pulling them off as you use it. The problem with that one, if you get lazy and you keep three up there and you keep using three, and you need to keep peeling it off and you being on number 10.
I mean, I guess I, because after I watched Citizen 4 on HBO, the Edward Snowden documentary, and I'm sure it's available everywhere, it's really, really good. I thought, I should look into all this encrypted stuff. I should mm-hmm. start looking into encrypted email.
Yes.
I should start looking into encrypted messaging. We could do mm-hmm. We Are Libertarians chat and encryption.
Yes.
And then I realized, why would we? Like, I send and receive maybe one or two personal emails a month. And it's always just somebody messaging me for We Are Libertarians, like, hey, can I get on the show? And I write back, no.
Go away, nerd.
Right, go away, nerd. I rarely, if ever, read email newsletters, but I don't send personal email. What we talk about in chat is mostly memes and dick jokes and, how famous we're all going to be someday, all that kind of stuff.
But let's fill up their servers with our encryption. Let's fill it up.
But why go through the extra hassle of forcing these four guys to do encryption and go to a separate bucket when really it's not even necessary, Like, what is the point of encrypted messaging if really all you're doing is just sending memes to each other?
Well, obviously,
when you do need to send something private to each other, it doesn't seem anything's weird. It's like, okay, Spangler and Lenz is sending emails. So we're like, oh, that one's encrypted? Why did they send this one
like
encrypted?
Tom Brady not turning his phone over mm-hmm. in Deflategate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
what ended up, cinching it.
It's like, whoa.
Why did you use it? What were you communicating about here? Yeah.
But that's a flag. And the other thing is...
Let it be a flag, so what?
No. And the simple fact that how many people that listen to the podcast that see us forcing people to use encryption, forcing people to do this thing, and they're like, you know what, we should too. And then you get the ball rolling of getting people to use encryption.
Network effects.
Yes. Like even one of the podcasts I follow, they wanted to make their own open source kind of like Facebook, but like on the side of Facebook. It's a decentralized like social network, so they control what gets posted, who can post what on their little separate side, but still be a part of Facebook. You know, breaking off their centralized control of it.
Yeah,
it's called Friendica. I don't know if anyone has seen it.
Yeah,
it's the podcast is Hack Five.
Gotcha.
I don't know. I'm kind of obviously I'm against the collection of data. You know, I don't like it, but I mean this the government's mandating the companies do it. Granted, they probably offer subsidies out the wazoo mm-hmm. in order to do it, so it makes it extremely profitable. And it's, you know, telecom's interesting. You know, a network is only as valuable as the number of users that are on it that are mm-hmm. you want to access. And I do, though, it's not networks are, you know, building a network startup or a competitor to an AT&T or to a Verizon or something like that is just so incredibly difficult because the value of a network effect type company is only the number of users you have squared. And so when mm-hmm. you know, you can hit exponential growth, but getting to that size is so incredibly difficult.
Getting access to the fiber optic channel.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing. And that's what Harbinger, you know, the Light Squared, mm-hmm. they got stopped from doing satellite, the satellite Wi-Fi.
Right.
You know, the government stopped them. And so I guess, is encryption the only fight back that we really have as, you know, as individuals?
Not necessarily. There's a lot of people that are really into mesh networking. Basically, we only...
Your own little intranet?
Well, yeah. Well, a lot of people use their own little intranet for different things.
Yeah.
But more of allowing those networks to talk to each other. There's several different products out there in the wings that are... They're just... I don't know if any of them are going to make it, but I like they got the ball rolling. Like MadeSafe, using the cryptography from Bitcoin to almost as like a...
Oh, the blockchain?
Yeah, using the blockchain, the open... Ledger to basically use that as a DNS to basically go around and
what? Nobody listening's no one has any idea what you just said. Nobody,
all right.
YouTube nerds.
Basically, all in all, what MadeSafe is going to do is basically allow you to use the extra hard drive space and power of your laptop, long as it stays connected to the MadeSafe network, to be used as a MadeSafe server. So people who can want to put data on the MadeSafe network gets transferred around, so there's a little bit on your computer, a little bit on my computer, a little bit on his computer.
It's LimeWire, but...
Gosh. Spread out, seated okay. everywhere. It's everywhere but nowhere.
So we're all criminals.
Yes. And it basically, so we're only using their bus, basically, to transfer data. And even if we can get past that and we just mesh everybody's Wi-Fi networks together and we just make this huge type of mesh network, that's one way to do it. But the other drawbacks from it, the other problem is because we're reduced to the 2.4 spectrum.
And if the government joined it.
Hmm?
And if the government, they could join it. That's the other issue. It's like the dark. It's like the deep web.
They could, yeah. Well, they can join. It's either they can join and no one cares, or there's no point of doing it at all.
Yeah.
So he's like, okay, so what? You're on. You can't see anyone else. No one here is beholden to you. There's no centralized place that for you to take down. So what? Join.
But then they're basically getting access without ever having to. They're getting access to all that data without ever having to go to a FISA court and get a subpoena for the records because
they have to break the encryption.
They'd have to break the encryption. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It just seems like it's, and I don't mean to be, you know, nihilistic, but it's, you know, it's tough to devise to figure out a way, like what options you really even have to prevent the bulk collection of your data, to stop the government's in, you know, tentacles from every corner of your communications life.
Give them crap.
Give them crap, yeah.
Give them crap.
Yeah.
Give them so much crap they don't know what to do with it. Upload as many cat photos as you can. Fill those hard drives up as fast as you can.
Meme
the crap out of them.
I'm on it.
What do we have available? We have memes. We have the brutalists and the memes, and Lord knows they are... That actually could work.
And then encrypt everything you get your hands on. Encourage other people to encrypt. If we were just going to have like a wall key signing party, we get all the wall members here and we pass out, we get everyone start using PGP encryption and have a key signing party.
Is there anyone that automates that process seamlessly so you have to do very little?
Mailvelope is pretty good at it.
Okay.
You just have to be careful because Mailvelope does have a... The problem with Mailvelope, if your machine, your hard machine is pwned, there's nothing else that can solve to help you. But if your machine's pwned, there's not much else you can do anyways.
Okay, because that's the thing is like for a lot of this stuff is that it adds steps and creates friction from users from adopting it.
Yeah, but Mailvelope does a really nice Thunderbird. what's the iOS email server that does it? That does it pretty good. Apple has a really nice one that does it really good to send email, PGP encrypted emails. The biggest problem is to give everyone your public PGP key.
Yeah.
And that's why they have key servers and stuff like that. Yeah. And there's all kinds of different services out there that those kind of people are out there trying to make it easier for to make people to adopt it.
Yeah. That's always the key. That's the kicker, is if you can make it seamless and there's a benefit, if there's no difference mm-hmm. between your way you're having to do things now, but it's encrypted and secure, mm-hmm. then you can usually get adoption if you offer some sort of incentive to sign up. Yeah. But if you don't, people don't use it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's stuff out there. Like, I've seen somebody's encryption on a computer that came in that basically, in the way the guy designed it, was the simple fact that the only way to erase or access the hard drive was to put the passcode in wrong 10 times. Once you've put it in wrong 10 times, it gives you no warning. It just starts erasing itself.
Okay.
You have no idea what's going wrong. It goes, you know, like, it just kind of screen goes
it's
blank.
It's like an DDoS attack, yeah. Except for password.
Yeah, it just goes blank, and then it goes back on, and then it just has a spinning, like, waiting moment. It's like, you know, it's basically, it's lying to you. It's telling you that, like, oh, wait 30 minutes for to try the code again. But in reality, what it's doing is erasing itself.
Yeah. it's self-destructing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we should wrap up on this and then move on to the next subjects, because we're already at an hour.
Are we really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yes.
How's
yes.
chat going?
No, that has nothing to do with it. I'm trying to get us to down to about an hour and a half.
I know, I'm joking. I'm just busting.
You know what? Fuck you, Greg.
I'm rustling your jimmies, dear leader. Do not be mad.
No. Are you upset?
Yeah.
So.
Lynn's brought up on treason charges.
Yeah, right?
Top five things from our resident nerd, Harry. Who now, after listening to this, the whole thing I've been thinking the whole time that we've been sitting here and listening to this conversation is, why did I give him my password to my Wi-Fi?
Right?
You give it to me or I will take it by force.
You know what's really sad is he only asked for it again this time to just make sure he hadn't changed it.
Greg, now I'm even more paranoid.
You should be very paranoid.
I'm not going to mess with you that bad.
That's where those other 17 gigabits are going. gigabytes are going that you're not getting, that you're paying for. Harry's living high on the hog.
Oh, that reminds me. Did you hear about the router hack that came out about, like, I think it was like a week ago? No. About, like, all these different routers that are affected by this malware?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, it's probably your router because you probably use factory software on there still.
Firmware?
Yeah.
All right, moving on to the next topic. Forget Harry. He doesn't get five things to protect the audience. All right, so just to summarize, change your password monthly.
Yep.
Yes, change your passwords. Wi-Fi passwords, too. Do not use default password. Go through all your things and find out if you have a default password. Get rid of it.
Shut up, Harry.
Get a password manager. Use it. Love your password manager. Harry,
preferably from a .gov website.
Harry is my password manager.
Oh, you're in good hands?
He's my personal password manager.
Yeah. Third thing is encrypt all the things. If it can be encrypted, encrypt it. If it can't be encrypted, get something else. Get rid of it.
Okay.
Let's see. That's three.
Meme the government. Yes. Always meme the NSA.
Meme the government. Upload as many cat photos as you can. You know, if they want to capture everything, make sure they've got at least a petabyte of your cat.
That's I'm doing everything. I downloaded 150 memes from 9GAG today.
Between 3:30 and 4:30. You had sent 21 memes. I was impressed in chat. That was quite the display of memery.
I was so bored this afternoon. I was like, I'm going to go on 9GAG and Reddit and let's see what we got. And I was like, memes everywhere. Send them to all the people in all the chats.
And let's see. The fifth thing is, when you leave your house, turn off the Bluetooth and Wi-Fi off your phone.
Ooh, yeah. Okay.
That's huge.
Why?
The reason why is because your Wi-Fi signal on your phone, it's trying to find the Wi-Fi access points you have accessed before. So let's say you connect to here, which is the one we connected to, Spangle Love Bear 92 access point.
92?
Yeah. Anyway, so, yeah.
How old are you telling your neighbors you are?
This year's my balls dropped.
So the access point will constantly keep looking for Spangle Bear 92. Now, let's say I'm a bad person and I see that, this Apple here keeps looking for Spangle Bear 92 access point. I make my device try to mimic.
Spoof it.
Spangle Bear 92. You connect to Spangle Bear 92. You have internet access. You have no idea why you have internet access, but you just keep going. Oh, let's say it's your phone. It's just in your pocket. Now I have access to it because you didn't encrypt your phone.
Basically, Harry's saying that he owns you.
No, I know. I'm just thinking through that. I've given him access to everything in my house, and I have a webcam. I have several webcams.
It used to be a big pastime of me to go
I have a drop cam.
People's wireless IP camera, or the IP cameras they have on their phone.
Yeah.
I used to, like, that's my favorite subreddit. I'll sit and watch people do stuff in their house all day.
See, I'm naked most of the time. Uh-huh. I want you to know that. Uh-huh.
So. That's item six of what you can do.
Oh, man.
Just taking photos and just like, just in case I ever get into trouble.
I'll tell you.
I need a character witness.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time nude. How about you boys? Huh? Fellas? Huh?
No, nope. Can't say that's.
You have roommates, don't you, at the frat house?
Yeah, no, I don't do the nude that much. Do you do the nude that much, really?
All the time.
Are you joking?
I was naked on that chair you're sitting on earlier.
Mm.
Huh?
Damn. Well, that's breaking the man code. You're supposed to say that. Anyways,
that's all a lie.
I like pants. Pants. I wear pants all the time. Because I get cold very easily. I am that guy at the Indiana State Fair drinking coffee in the wool suit. I'm that guy. Yeah, three-piece suit, tie, everything, drinking coffee, walking through. It's like, man, it's cold, this state fair.
See, I'm like sweating my balls off right now, and it's 66 degrees in here.
Yeah,
I have the air at 66, and it's May.
I get vetoed every time on trying to keep the AC off as long as possible. And I get the accountant on board, like, hey, you know how much money we can save? We don't turn this on until at least August.
It is 66 degrees outside, and we'll drop to 61, and my air is at 66.
That's freezing.
I love it.
We should have a fire going.
The reason that women are always colder than men is their temperature receptors are closer to the top of their skin. Mm. Men's are deeper. Mm. So you must be a woman.
You like how you did that?
I know. Yeah,
all right, Greg.
That was just right out of the park.
So let's get to the trans stuff. Let's get to the trans union.
The Trans Pacific.
My favorite club in Indianapolis, the Trans Union.
Oh my gosh.
Trading club.
So you left the unicorn. They finally get rid of Nickel Beer Night.
Yes. Sorry, I left Greg's. That's a local establishment.
Establishment. Yes, it is.
Gina wants. Went barefoot at a foam party.
That's right.
Don't you remember that story?
I do. That was a story time with Gina.
Yeah, story time with Gina, and she was at Greg's at the gay bar, and they had a foam party. So it was up to everybody's waist, and it was up to her neck in foam because she's tiny. And she was walking around barefoot, just soggy, soggy, soggy mess at the bottom of the gay bar.
So many soggy knees.
And it's not even that it's a gay bar. It's just that it's bar.
Foam.
Right.
It's foam.
It's foam, and it's a bar.
And it's communal foam. You know, they got rid of public bathhouses for a reason.
See, I was fine
communal
like, at foam parties.
That is
like, while I was drinking. But the moment I started to sober up and realizing what's going on, I was like, I need to leave.
As parallel Mexicans was our phrase for last week, communal foam.
Communal
is
foam. Communal foam. Wall's going to have a communal foam party and no one's going to come.
So kids, grab your Dakota rings this week. Yeah. Communal foam. Send your letters into Postmark. All right, so the TransUnion Trading Club.
I'm going to say it now. Okay. You're going to have me saying inappropriate things that I'm going to get in trouble for. Well, actually, I won't be able to come on next week, even though. but basically, I mean, it's similar to it's NAFTA, but it's Pacific Asian oriented. So it's nine countries negotiating a trade agreement. It includes standards of operation. It includes intellectual property. It includes protections for small and medium business who feel like they're getting steamrolled on this because they're not going to be able to really. Their big concern is that the regulatory oversight is going to be so expensive, it's going to negatively affect small and medium-sized businesses.
You think?
And they're right. And, you know, it's one of those things where the theoretical makes perfect sense. Any type of trade agreement is absolutely a good thing. it opens up. It has so many positive effects by opening up trade with other countries. But what it does get lost in the fray, and it's the reason the Democrats have stalled or threatening to stall it in the Senate, Elizabeth Warren specifically, is that it does. If we have tariffs in place, if we have any sort of protectionism in place, and this removes that, it does cause real life harm for individuals that are in a protected industry. So, for instance, in the United States, steel versus Chinese steel. You know, Bush, the free market god, introduced tariffs on U.S. Chinese steel because it helped keep steelworker jobs. And there is that sentiment. It isn't good. There isn't a benefit in the long run. The problem with these agreements is enforcement. Is everybody can sign under this agreement. Everybody can say, we're going to do X, Y, Z. We're not going to imply child labor in order to produce products. We're not going to exploit, and whether I know certain libertarians would debate that. But there are free trade in the long run is a great thing. But the human cost in the short term can be really tough politically.
Yeah. The whole thing with the steel thing, that affects my industry.
Yeah.
Since that trade deal has basically started becoming public knowledge, you could watch the commodity of steel price just drop, just dropping. I think it's at 50 cents now? Something ridiculous? It just keeps going. Because if you can get cheap Chinese steel possibly later in the future, why would you buy American steel?
I think for me, the thing that... It's so easy to sit and craft the perfect economy from scratch.
Totally.
And I think a lot of times that it totally... libertarians love to whiteboard an economy. And they want to whiteboard everything. It's like, okay, when we start a perfect society, here's how it's all going to work.
Liberland.
Right. And
then the Joker comes and just messes up the whole whiteboard.
Yeah, and libertarians have not yet figured out how to stand in front of the steelworker and say, hey, sorry, love that open border free trade stuff.
Here's a book on Schumpeter and creative destruction. Don't worry, you're going to be fine.
Right. Mm-hmm. Explain creative destruction for the people.
Or Harry?
What?
No, you don't. Okay, no, I thought you wanted to chime in something. Basically, what it is that, markets, there's creative destruction in the fact that an old industry gets innovated away, and then those workers go into a new industry where they get higher wages or it is more advanced technologically. And since, whenever this happens, it's a more efficient production, the consumer then spends less money. And so all new fields are invented because if you get stagnant, you get left behind in a global economy. Mm-hmm. In an autarky where it's just one country, all production is done in-house, you can theoretically prevent new industry and keep people employed and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But in a global economy where everyone's competing for trade and access to consumers, there's no such thing as protectionism. Right. It is inevitable. You might be able to protect them for a little while, like with the tariffs on steel and that type of thing, but eventually black markets emerge.
Right.
Eventually, the market finds a way to provide for willing consumers. And so there is the human cost, but the creative destruction is a good thing as long as you don't live next door to the guy that's, a guy that builds Apple II computers. The hardware industry in the United States is now mainly refurbishing, repurposing.
Mm-hmm. And the really big builders, builders. They build gaming rigs for people or high-end machines for people.
Yep. Customized, we're at the level higher than, with labor not being cheap in the United States. If I've read it multiple times by Forbes, if the iPhone 4 was made in the United States, it would cost $5,000 retail. Right. Mm-hmm. Which is incredible to think about. And so we all benefit because less of our budget each month goes to that type of thing. And so that's why the free trade is a good thing, is that there's comparative advantage. Countries specialize in what they do well. Mm-hmm. When you have two countries, though, that compete by offering similar services, what ends up happening, or what really drives the labor unions crazy in the United States, is the lack of enforcement. And that their guys that are in their union are paying dues. And for the most part, the ones that are willing to play ball and not, strike and are willing to accept that the world changes, when there's no enforcement and they get undermined and they're going to lose their jobs anyway, they get really upset, and that's what's happened with organized labor in the United States, mm-hmm. is they do not like, they saw what happened in NAFTA. There's no enforcement mechanisms to make sure that everybody's playing by the same rules.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, and you could probably talk about that directly. I mean, the data destruction industry, the e-waste here versus China. How much more expensive is it for you guys versus just shipping it over to China, dropping it in a landfill, and then polluting and killing, you know, children with three arms? I mean, that's honestly, you watch the 60 Minutes piece on that, and it's...
I've actually asked my boss that, and he told me that if we didn't have to responsibly recycle any of this stuff away, that he could literally pay for me to give me a company Mercedes-Benz. Mm. You know, I'd come here on my daily i7 laptop that I probably just used that day and just go home.
Yeah.
It's because it's the cause of having to do this stuff correctly.
Right.
And a lot of places don't
care. And not because illegally, but because it's morally right. It's right.
It's morally the correct way to do it. Like, there's some of the people that comes in and just assumes that we pay everyone in our teardown department. Oh, all those guys back there tearing the stuff down, separating that stuff, they must be making a minimum wage. My boss looks insulting. It's like, you, how dare you say that to me? It's like, I do not pay these guys minimum wage. And it almost looks like he's getting ready to kick these people out.
Yeah.
From the just insinuating that they think these people, the quote-unquote lessers who are just sitting there tearing stuff down, make minimum
the
wage.
The manual, you know, the people that aren't mm-hmm. you know, the soft skill types.
Yeah,
and they have arguably the most responsive job with the penalties associated with mm-hmm. data leak.
Yep.
Data breach.
Data leak. And they have the most dangerous job. That's my boss will do everything in his power to make sure that job is safe for them. And we give them everything they need so they can basically go home. To make sure, like, we were regulated to make sure we have, like, air quality tests. We make sure the air is actually cleaner inside our facility versus outside. We've actually had to test it. It's cleaner to breathe inside our facility than to be off of 30th Street.
Well, yeah. Not commenting on 30th Street, but now we, you know, you refuse to name your employer, but based on the metadata, we know that it's on 30th Street in Indianapolis, Indiana. That's not too many competitors. You're looking for protection. I think we could probably figure this out, Harry.
Enough metadata.
Yeah, but this partnership, this is why it's so important to President Obama. This is the future. So when President Nixon, and it's funny we keep using Nixon with Obama. When he went over to China to open up trade and build a relationship, at the time we would have it was based on really getting a rogue nation to adjust to more historical norms, but then also we possibly saw it as an avenue for consumers, and that's never really for U.S. producers to sell to Chinese and Asian consumers, and that's never materialized. The Asian economies have had a very protective. Mindset against American goods, mm-hmm. and so that's why this is so important. Is this reduces or almost eliminates the majority of Asian tariffs on U.S. made products and services, and so the president sees that and sees that when the Chinese middle class, if they ever let that the yuan rise in value and they start having some consumer purchasing power. And, you know, as long as the Chinese Communist Party lets access to the Chinese market, that is unbelievable growth as they have a, you know, burgeoning middle class. Mm-hmm. And the same with, you know, not so much like Singapore and Japan's older than we are, but maybe healthcare services. You know, you never can really tell. That's that creative destruction part. What services will be provided in the future and will really drive the U.S. domestic economy based on exports? Because we don't know the industries that will in 15 years don't exist yet, probably.
Right.
You know, and
so,
and then IP laws, it does give a regulatory administration for cracking down on intellectual property rights. Like, so it's going to cut down on theft on American. I mean, the movie studios are going to love it. I know.
No. I'm not even going to get at that. It's like a. The old guard in Japan, the whole fact that they're protecting like a lot of their old way they do copyright of anime and manga and making sure they do that is what's really killing the anime industry. People in the United States eat that crap up. They are people that are willing to pay for it. That's why Crunchyroll is doing okay. But the fact that they're willing to pay for, but they're not want to wait. Like, I don't want to wait 5 years to get the next episode of One Piece. I want one. I know One Piece launched in Japan. I know that episode just came out. I have the internet. I want that episode now.
So
I'm willing to pay for it.
Yeah.
But if you won't give me an avenue to pay for it, well, guess what? Someone will give it to me for free.
And I'll gladly do it because yes. then I like, pay like we said, the black or, you know, the black market provides access to the willing consumer.
Yeah. Because that's how I got used to get most of my anime because you couldn't get it. It was too hard to get. I would bootleg it. Now I'm a Crunchyroll subscriber.
Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways, we're already kind of here. NAFTA helped push us in this direction. Where major U.S. economies are built on the backs of licensing, essentially, where we are licensing technology and we're hiring out to third-party companies to build certain things in China and India. And it all circles around patents and licensing. And then we build a service economy here at home. And so the more people we have, the more people to serve, you know, the more people can work on some level of innovation. Mm-hmm. Does that increase, and is that a sustainable economic model for the United States of America?
It is.
Okay.
That is ideally because that type of economy commands the highest wage. So that is what you want is you want an information technology economy, an idea economy, instead of individuals going to work and exchanging their ability to do a job for a wage physically, you instead are going to pay people for what commands the highest wages possible, and that is their creative abilities, their ability to get projects off the ground, lead projects, project management. Now, I know the arts community would probably be fighting, kicking, and screaming. But ultimately, it's the free market, you know. Like, so if you work in drama or, you know, anything, they say, well, we're in the creative, you know, but they say there's no jobs for them to be an actor. Not there's always room for someone to create a play from scratch and to, you know, raise the funds to rent out a playhouse and have a recurring show. That is the talent and the ability that if you can build an economy around where you get concentrations of wealth that are enormous.
But aren't we already starting to see cracks in that kind of economy where the middle class is disappearing, the gap between wealthy and poor is increasing, social benefits start increasing.
Where does the middle class come from? I mean, the middle class came about because there was a huge demand for physical products and the United States had the industrial capacity to do it. And since there was there were very few other competitors since we decimated Germany and the rest of Europe had been in war in World War I and then World War II, their industrial capacity had been decimated. We were left standing with a window of 20 years where we could pay extremely high wages because in that model, it's that autarky I was talking about. Mm-hmm. The more you pay your individuals in the shorter time they work, the more time they have to go spend the extra money they have, and they just keep creating demand. And it's that Keynesian argument. And it works until you have competitors in a system.
Yeah. Well, like, what if, like, the middle class is mostly built from two-income families? Most people, most people aren't getting married. Most people don't have two income. Myself and my fiance, we're a two income household. We found out, like, just like crunching our numbers, like, oh crap, we're actually a middle class household because there's two of us. One of us by ourselves we're not middle class, but both of us together makes us middle class. So yeah, the getting rid of people getting married, I think that has to do a lot with the shrinking of the middle class.
And so it is a concern because it goes to the human cost of it. You know, it goes to what happens when someone's 55 years old and their marketable skills are in an industry that they can only go get $6 an hour in Vietnam. That's where the way this agreement's being designed is that there'll be assistance. But it is
assistance.
That's what I mean. I know. It's like you said, you know, the libertarian looks at it and it's the theoretical and it's that we can design this system so everybody can, even if you're 55, we'll send you to college for 4 years. We'll pay for it. You can go learn a new skill.
Well, and then what are you going to do?
I know. That's the but.
You're not going to compete with somebody like Harry, who started building these skills at 8 years old.
Exactly, exactly. And
it's just,
so
it's just biology. It's psychology. It's you cannot compete with the advantage that Harry has because of the depth of his experience and how ingrained it is into the functioning of his brain. And I hate to be Debbie Downer, but you cannot take a 57-year-old and send them to college and then put them in the same role as Harry, because they cannot compete with Harry's skills.
For sure.
Because Harry may have done this for 10 years and they may, you know, have 5 years of experience and 60 years. It just doesn't compare, because Harry's brain has been formed and shaped and molded by what he's doing now.
No doubt.
You know.
And that is the tough part about, you know, trade agreements and being the free trade mindset, is the human costs are serious. And the problem with human costs is human costs materialize in political backlash.
Yeah.
And ultimately, when you look at it, you know, political systems are really important. Forms of governments, what forms of welfare states, mm-hmm. that such how you organize such things. And so you look at this, and given a lot of baby boomers, you know, baby boomers are no doubt like they're the first modern, I would argue, demographic, in the fact that there is a big bifurcation. There are those that are doing well, have plenty of assets, and are set up for a nice retirement, and then there's the other half is going to work forever.
Yeah.
Never stop. And when you get social unrest is when you have a big economic disruption, and it isn't brought about gradually. And, you know, even the training and those types of things don't really, unless the person buys in and there's no government that can force you to say you're really going to take to this retraining program. And then who's to say that program they went into is worthless in 5 years anyway.
Every time Harry's on, it's super depressing about the future of work. But we're shifting. We're going from an agrarian to the Industrial Revolution. Huge shift in work patterns and migration. Mm-hmm. You know, then now we're moving towards. Then you go from the industrial into what would you call it? The
information.
I like the creative term. Everything is creative.
Yeah, but I guess we weren't industrial in the 60s. Technically, were we?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And so now we're moving from more industrial.
We're still
the
largest manufacturer on Earth. It's just automated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so now we're moving towards more of the creative economy, the idea economy, and that's a totally different shift. And our education system has completely left us ill-prepared, because people like Rockefeller and Vanderbilt and everybody who designed the education system 100 years ago said, we need this kind of worker. Turn these out for our factories. Mm-hmm. Turn these out for our 17-floor white-collar jobs, Rose, Mad Men type situations,
right,
where you're just a little worker bee typing things in. That doesn't exist. Now you need creative thinking. Now you need writing skills. Now you need coding skills. Now you need to train your brain to do all these different things. And it's totally possible. It's just people are a little lazy and entitled.
Exactly. When I was in when I went to IPS schools, I was in an algebra class. We had a just really difficult like word problem, right? It was how to design the maximum number of parking spaces, you know, in this little spot, right? Everyone was doing all their math equations to make this little spot. I just had the bright idea to like, it doesn't say we can't build a parking garage, so let's build a parking garage. I built so we got together, got the engineering, and started writing together, and we built the 37-floor parking garage next to this two-story mall. Technically, we had more parking spaces than anybody that could design, because we had 37 floors. We got an F on it because we went outside the bounds of the problem.
Mm. Nice.
Yeah, and that's the point, is that, right, you know, the creative economy, when your training is being creative in a straitjacket.
Yeah,
you know, and
it's impossible. It's maddening.
It is, and it all. This is all like it all comes together, because this agreement, it is good, because comparative advantage is good. It benefits everyone. People specializing and countries specializing in what they do well. Economies forming around that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most efficient use of resources, which means it's the cheapest for the consumer in the aggregate. You know, the less money you have to, like the buy local. I know I rail against it, because to me, and I'm not telling people what to do, but why would you pay more for something to support local jobs when you have less available in your budget to spend on other things. It's the broken window fallacy. You're spending more to keep a job here than maybe you would spend on getting your dry cleaning done twice a week, and now the dry cleaner closed. It's the unseen dollars that you're now spending to buy local mm-hmm. for goods that have alternatives that are just as good. They're just not locally produced.
Yes.
What beer are you drinking, Greg?
Triton.
A local brewer.
Yeah, it's because it's 7%, not because it's...
yes. yeah, that's why I had to get off it. If it was like, man, I don't drink beer like this.
No, it's okay beer. I mean, you know, but I don't...
I'm just teasing you. Yeah, buy local, except from the Broad Ripple Brewery.
No. I'm saying, like, don't just automatically buy into the buy local. Yeah. Think about it, because it isn't as simple as, well, I'll support local jobs. If it's the truly same price and the same quality, whatever you want to do.
Right.
Yeah, I love Wemac. I love the taste of it, but I'm not paying that price. I laugh at it. Like, I'm not paying that much for a Wemac. Give me an ice house any day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
like this agreement's good in the fact, I mean, that intellectual property is a whole nother talk. Mm-hmm. Because this creates an enforcement mechanism with the Asian countries, like where there's been mass piracy of the creative economy.
Yes.
Over there.
Yep.
U.S. creative economy. And this does push things in a direction where hopefully we don't have that piracy as much, but I don't know that it's now that information's digital, I don't know how you ever enforce that. Maybe they just don't like market it in the streets of Beijing selling DVDs for a movie that's not out yet.
Piracy's going to be there.
Always.
It's going to be there. But if you worry about the pirates, that you're worrying about the past, your past thing that you've
exactly.
done, just keep moving forward. Keep making a better product.
The other thing is ripped off corporations, you know, like pharmaceuticals or medical devices, you know, mm-hmm. cutting edge that they've spent billions on and then are not able to monetize and hire new people to create the next industry because someone didn't respect the patent law.
Right.
You know, that's the other unseen thing. You know, they've spent billions creating it, and then a Chinese company says, oh, we were able to get access by hacking the corporate database. We're just going to build it and try to sell it to U.S. consumers without ever having any of the fixed investment costs, the research, the R&D.
Yeah.
Well.
But that's a good thing, I think, in the short term, because it once you can get free trade once you have fair trade.
Right.
Yeah. Once you get everybody playing by the same rules, and this is a step in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Then we can start really talking about free and open borders, free trade, yes. growth economies.
Mm-hmm. I think the best outcome is less war.
Yes,
that's exactly what it is.
Because do you think that? I mean, you look at the Chinese and the Americans; these two major superpowers. They are never going to. Well, China's going to become a superpower at some point.
That is the superpower.
What China is?
Yeah, they actually have money.
Yeah.
No, they don't. They have more debt than we do.
But
you know that? Huh? They have more debt than we do.
Well, because it's some. Yeah, yeah.
And they're older demographically.
Yeah.
That's a dangerous thing with no social safety net.
But you're never going to see America and China seriously face off on a war because they have too many combined mutual interests.
Our economy fails, their economy fails.
Exactly right. So.
They've got more kids. Yeah, they have.
And that's why libertarians don't like sanctions, except Rand Paul.
He's not a libertarian.
He's a libertarian Republican.
He's a paleo-conservative with libertarian leanings.
All right, kiddies, we need to start wrapping it up. So let's, you can hear us, and we're going to try and not do massive episodes because I hate having to cut so much out of, we now do libertytalks.fm
mm-hmm.
on Saturdays from 10 to noon. Check out libertytalks.fm. Check out, we're also on lrn.fm. Two internet streaming libertarian talk radio networks, very cool networks.
Mm, nice.
So yeah, check them out. All right, let's wrap up. So let's give your final thoughts, Harry. Is there anything that you missed that you didn't get to talk about?
Let's see. One thing I do want to bring up is I don't want to give anyone get like the wrong impression about me, like when I go, like when I talk about like this high tech stuff. That is from like a lot of hard work from what I've got from it. Like I said, a lot of people assume I've probably went to some like a college preparatory school. Like I've been said like
Northwestern.
Yeah, yeah. I went to IPS. I'm an IPS survivor. I went to IPS my entire life. I had terrible teachers, great teachers, but...
Right. State's largest school system in Indiana, and really just a big bag of shit.
Yeah, it's crap. It's utter crap. I was able to graduate out of that place my start of my junior year, but they wouldn't let me go because I would ruin the funding and ruin graduation rates come 2003 when I got out of that place.
Yep.
They made me take classes over that I've already passed just to give me stuff to do so I wouldn't leave.
Right.
And then even when I did get out of school, they didn't give me the best base skills to survive in college when I went to IEPUI. I didn't have the skill set to survive in college. I ended up leaving college. I went to I did bartending. I did bartending for a few years, and then I found my joy of doing projects. I love projects, and I took that joy of doing projects, and I started doing catering halls, and then from that, but I still always had my love for IT. I just only recently, I always have done that on the
side.
And
more hardware than anything, right?
Right. So basically, what I'm just saying is like, I've always had a passion for electronics. I'm not doing it because it makes me money. I love this stuff. I go home and I do this. So I was able to find how to make money at something that I love, and I will always keep working at it. I encourage anyone else to find something that they love doing, be the best at that, and find out how to get paid.
Watching television. Can I do it?
To get paid?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can.
I sort of kind of have.
You can. You can get paid for watching television. I know a lot of people that get paid for watching television.
Sort of basically have.
There's people that get paid to play video games.
Yeah, it's very true. I think in life you have to find out what you're passionate about, and you have to devote yourself to that passion, and then from there you will find ways to make money from that.
Yes.
You know, but you have to be a self-study, polymath. Polymath?
Yeah.
I don't know how you say that.
There's people that have made money just talking, telling jokes into microphones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He works for two.
No, no. I worked for a couple of guys who figured out how to get rich off of dick jokes. Yeah. Gregory?
The creative economy.
Yeah.
Two things. There is one thing to always consider, and this is something that gets lost in the fray of free market absolutists, is that there are very important benefits associated with being a economy where you actually make things.
Right.
And the benefit is, if you have an economy that's purely based in the information sciences and you're not used to the manufacturing, the research and development with the hands-on experience, you don't have the ability to ever make the game-changing revolutions or the discoveries because you're not working in that field. And you can't monetize those and incorporate those here because you don't have the industrial base, or you don't have the clusters that tend to be necessary for an economy to thrive, like a Detroit was and then isn't. But like, look at Silicon Valley, you know, look at their contributions. Or Stanford alone has contributed $12 trillion to the U.S. economy over the last 10 years. It's amazing, and you need those little clusters, and it can only happen. If it's just purely creative, you never are able to make the breakthroughs in medical and in manufacturing and steel and all the things we need. And then that also exposes you, given the world doesn't always stay peaceful, if you don't have those types of industries within your country because you specialize in higher level, come wartime, it's pretty tough to build up the industrial sector in order to manufacture drones or to build your computer systems here.
That's why we have hobbyist droners.
But yeah. No, but I mean, like, you know, there are certain strategic interests, because I would love to tell you that the way the world goes is everybody's libertarian, everybody gets along.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing you always have to worry about is until our state fails and it's the perfect endpoint, you have to keep certain things in-house should you ever need them.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the good thing about America is that we have, when you're as rich as America, you have a tremendous amount of resources, and you have access to a lot of various resources. And I think sometimes, and I guess this will be my final thing if you're done, but I'll piggyback off of that. When you are rich, you're always rich. Donald Trump went bankrupt, and look at him now.
He was worth -$900 million.
Right. And we are the Donald Trump rich of countries.
Yeah.
you know, you can have hard times and countries go through hard times, but when you are as rich in people, quality of people, for the most part, in my estimation, most Americans still are good. Most Americans still want to wake up and live decent lives and work hard. You know, there is certainly segments of population that don't want to do that. Thinking of mostly everyone who worked for my dad at the janitorial company.
Yeah.
But even then, that's not fair because they, you know.
Still showed up.
80% of them wanted to work hard and just move up and do something different and make and earn extra money at night. And the other 20 didn't want to get scheduled 30 hours a week because they didn't want to go over for their Social Security or for their welfare or their benefits. You know, and this was the 80s and 90s, for God's sake.
Marauds.
You know, America is rich in so many different resources. People, money, natural, land. You know, so even when and if we go through hard times, we eventually will pull ourselves out of it. We just have to start being smarter. we have to start choosing better politicians and... you know, government is not the answer, but
don't look to them for leadership and guidance.
You know, I was talking to a friend this morning, and she was having a relationship problem. She just kept going on and on and on about how her boyfriend was this or, you know, wasn't this, and it was that, and there was this thing, and he does this, and blah, 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 blah. And I just said, you know, the best thing you can do is to discover who you are, learn your values, and work on the things that you need to improve about yourself, and then that relationship will either fix itself or it will end, and it will just work out naturally. And I think America is really kind of in that place. We need to stop trying to fix Iraq and fix China and fix all these other places. Just need to do what's best for our nation, because if we're going to be jingoistic, nationalistic all the way, let's do it right.
Yeah.
You know,
Let's actually be number one,
right,
instead of number 29.
Right. In all these different areas, put every option on the table, get rid of dogma. You know. And I think that libertarians, for the most part, we have to lead the way in being open-minded and flexible and getting rid of dogma and putting all these talking points that the left and right bring and saying, put those on the shelf and let's start discussing ideas and solutions. And let's not try and maneuver for power. Let's figure out what's going to be best for us. Because once we figure out what's best for us in education, then that is going to help us propel us back to number one in so many different areas. You know, education is so important. Energy is huge. National security in my America, ladies and gentlemen, is less important because we're trading with the rest of the world. We're enriching everyone else on the planet. We're enriching ourselves. We're giving prosperity to the planet and to the people of our nation, to the point that nobody wants to fight because war is the great wealth destroyer. That is the ultimate destructive economy. Other than mittens, I don't know if I think you might have heard that. That was the cat running past me.
Whoa!
Scared me. I thought there was like thunder or the roof was caving in. And so I think as individuals, what we can do. It's easy to sit here and say the nation is at an existential crisis and everybody else needs to get their house in order. I think you, as a listener, as a libertarian, you need to learn as much as you can about solutions. You need to be as decent of a person as you possibly can. You need to understand what you believe and what you think is important. And in my mind, it all starts with respecting other human beings. Starts with respect of the individual, respecting that I own my own body and I do not own Greg's own body. The very foundational principle of libertarianism is that you own yourself and you govern yourself and you determine what is right for you. You work with the other people around you, whether your family, your friends, your coworkers, in voluntary exchanges to improve your situation. And once you just kind of ingest that idea and start applying that value and to every aspect of your life, you're going to be radically changed by it. I will tell you. I mean, the idea that alone changes so many things that you think. about other people. I mean, that idea alone has taught me to treat women with more respect. You know, like, I know it's really weird. I'm sorry, Harry. I didn't mean to offend you with my newfound feminism. But, you know, as a man, there's so many things that you do that you're just like, oh, that's really disrespectful. You know, or walking up to somebody and just like touching them, like, get your hands off of them. Don't touch them. You know, like, I don't know if I'm starting to ramble, but you know what I mean?
No, I get your point.
Like,
yeah.
Just even that idea in basic human interactions with other people, it starts to transform how you treat others.
That self-awareness will develop that you kind of lack.
You know, that sometimes when you are conditioned to think that other people are your property, sorry here, then you start to treat people differently, and you start to lose little pieces of your own humanity. And libertarianism brings that back, and I think that's the key. And so you have to get those fundamentals first. You know, you have to get those ideas ingrained in you first. Check out the Path to Libertarianism at wearelibertarians.com, where we kind of walk you through some of these big ideas and the first three ideas at free markets and self-ownership and what it means to be a libertarian. So check that out. Spread it around. Pass it around. You know, it's the idea that you own yourself and not others that really can change the world and start to draw people back. Because instead of going to these workers and saying, I'm sorry, your jobs are going away, let's send you to college, we're going to go put you in a state school and train you how to be a good state-sponsored flunky.
Don't worry, you're going to need finite. We can't tell you how. You're not
going to
understand
how. We're going
how.
To teach you how to think the way that we think is important. Wouldn't it be better if we just said, you are the master of your own destiny. You figure it out. You know, and people in
here's a bunch of Coursera and Udemy credits, and you figure out what you think you can do.
Because in that same conversation with somebody today, they're like, well, I can change this person. I'm like, no, because everything is great right now. I did not become a better person in my marriage. I became a better person in my divorce. You know, like, going through tough times shapes you for the better or for the worse, but usually most people learn from it, grow from it, and become better in times of trial. And, you know, what we lack in this nation is optimism. You know, it is so easy and so comfortable and so acceptable to be negative and cynical. That is the default position of everybody, you know? And optimism so often is weird. Like, somebody's
naive.
Naive, and it's like, what? I think I've said on the podcast, like, my cousin and her boyfriend, I met them at, like, at a holiday party, and she's just so happy. And, like, I walked away the first time that I saw her, and I was like, man, I saw her at an event, and I was like, I can't believe my cousin is drunk. I said to the person I was with, I was like, that's embarrassing. She's so drunk. Because she was so positive and happy and sweet. It threw me off. So how can someone in my family be that happy? Okay. And then I saw her a couple weeks later, and I saw her again, and I saw her boyfriend, and he was exactly like her, and everything's great. I am so happy for you. Things just really, I'm glad. And I'm like, you don't have to insult me right to my face, okay?
Are you Mormon?
Right. It's very Mormon-esque. You know, and I walked away from that experience going, why did I have that reaction? I consider myself to be a fairly happy and optimistic person. I guess not. So,
yeah, no,
so I don't know.
That's
change,
true.
Change starts with you. It starts how you interact with people, because you can't expect the government and other people and politicians to change if you don't start changing what you believe and how you interact with others and how you treat others with respect.
Yeah, like, America never looked for saviors. And more and more it's like, well, who's going to found the next industry that's going to get us all jobs? And, you know, then we don't have to work till we're 85 and our economy grows. And the point is that it's no savior. Mm-hmm. It's that it's people focusing on what they do best and working on their skill, enhancing it, looking for breakthrough, pushing the envelope, and then it scales.
Right. Yep. Yeah.
All right, kids. Well, thank you for joining us on this episode of We Are Libertarians. Thank you, Harry, for joining us. Nice. All right, this is a podcast, so you can't just put your thumbs up. You have to actually say thank you or
thank you,
goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye, everybody.
Namaste, whatever you would like to
say.
Namaste.
What?
It's Islamic or Buddhist or something. Islamic. All right. Thanks for joining us here on this episode of We Are Libertarians. We appreciate you listening, for spreading it around. Our theme music is brought to you by Brian Keith Wallen. Love you, beautiful people. I felt like it was an episode of We Are Libertarians. It could have been good. It could have been bad. We are not the ones to judge that. That is up to you. But if you did not enjoy it, we promise
to do better next time.